Hello. Welcome to our CMD Bite Size series. In these podcasts, we will be exploring a range of ministry and theological issues. Good afternoon. Today I'm joined by Simon Fan, the Truro Food Bank Manager and Chair of Cornwall Living Wage Place Group. We'll be discussing some of the issues that are facing food banks today and looking at why as a society we have become so dependent on their existence. So thank you for joining me today, Simon. Could you begin by telling us a bit about your role within the food bank and what it involves?
So as the manager at Truro Food Bank, there's two sides to it, really. There's the operational side and what I'll call the strategic side. So the operational side is making sure that we have enough food coming in to meet the demand and to look after and manage two other part-time staff and the 70 wonderful volunteers that we have, without whom we couldn't function. So all the traditional things you'd think about with managers, like policies, procedures and all that sort of thing, comes in the operational bundle. The strategic side is going after the reasons and the causes that people come to us at Truro Food Bank. So one of the things I would say is anything I'm saying today really just applies to Truro Food Bank. It doesn't mean that every food bank works the same way or takes the same approach. But as we moved through COVID into the cost of living crisis, it became clear to us that just giving out more and more food to more and more people was not an answer. You really have to go after the reasons why people are being driven to food banks or come to food banks. And that's really what the campaigning side and the issue raising side and the collaboration side, all of that comes into the strategic work.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really helpful to understand the two perspectives of that. Do you get sufficient food into the food bank to provide what you need to provide?
Things have changed. So when I started at Truro Food Bank in 2019, I had 6 months before dear old COVID came along. So 6 months to establish what you might have then called normality before seeing what then happened. So at that point, Truro Food Bank fed 2,200 people a year and needed 33 tonnes of food to do that. And amazingly, by provision, that was exactly the amount of food that came in. There was very little that had to be spent on purchasing food. As we moved through the years 2019, 2021, figures went up. So from 2,200 to 3,000, 3,500, 4,000, 4,500, 5,000, 5,800. And amazingly, for a lot of that time, the donations of food kept pace with demand. And I thought, this cannot continue. There has to be a breaking point. And there was. So we're now at the situation that the biggest place that we get our donations of food is what the very generous members of the public purchase and put into the supermarket donation bins. That is by far and away the biggest source. That has dropped now by 14 tonnes over the last 2 years. So that is a huge gap. The amount of donated food we get from churches has amazingly stayed the same. The amount that we get at harvest festival time, usually 5 tonnes a year, amazingly, has stayed the same. But in the year before last, we needed 80 tonnes of food to give out. We didn't have it. So we've had to start buying food. At the moment, we are blessed in that since COVID, when a lot of people couldn't go out to actually buy food and put it into a donation bin, they set up standing orders and direct debits. Can I say a massive thank you to anybody who has done that, because they have stayed the same. And now that we are having to purchase food at the rate that we are, if we didn't have that kind of regular, stable income stream to budget on, then we would be lost.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's just an enormous increase, isn't it, in food provision that you're having to require. I was looking into it in advance and just seeing that the Truro Food Bank was set up under Trussell in 2009, and at that point it was the 37th food bank established. Probably, I guess then, they weren't that visible for people, but over time they've become a much more visible presence on our high streets, people much more aware of it in our communities. What's some of the impact been of that increased awareness with people?
Really, that again has two sides to that coin. The awareness side is important because one thing we always say is please do not leave it too late. If you are starting to struggle, if your family is starting to struggle, if you haven't got enough food for lots of different reasons that we'll probably come on to, then please make contact with your nearest food bank or food larder, because not everything has to be a Trussell-affiliated food bank. There are some really excellent independent food banks and community larders out there, but never leave it too late. We've had some people that come in and say, I've got absolutely nothing in the cupboards. I remember one guy saying he'd sat in his car outside our food bank distribution session for the last three sessions, and he was just too ashamed, embarrassed. He couldn't bring himself to come in, and then he finally did because he said, I've got nothing. I've got to come in now. So we try to say to people, please do make contact before you fall into that absolute pit of desperation. One of the things that I can tell you is when we started to look at the reasons people came, a couple of years ago we found that 30% of households coming to Truro Food Bank had at least one person employed. Now, there can be stigmas attached to food banks, and sometimes people think, I've got a job, I shouldn't be going to a food bank, or there's other people worse off than me. Please don't make those judgments. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't judge people that come in, so don't judge yourself too harshly. If you're in a situation that for whatever reason there isn't enough food to feed a family, you need to talk to a food bank. So I think the visibility and the awareness is good from the point of view that hopefully now people are doing that and they're aware that it isn't a shame or a stigma to use a food bank. The other side to that, though, is I think that food banks get taken for granted by politicians, business leaders, people that make decisions that could either help those that are struggling or actually make their situation worse. And if the temptation is for those leaders to think, it doesn't really matter if this policy works because there's always the voluntary sector, there's always the charities, there's always the food banks, and people can go there, then to me that's the wrong mindset. When Truro Food Bank was set up by Doreen and Malcolm Henderson in 2009, they were thinking this was going to be a short-term, three-year thing. Mm-hmm. They're probably horrified that here we are in 2025, and not only is the food bank still required, but the demands on it are increasing. And I think that speaks to the fact that some people are thinking, that's all right, they'll always be there. We don't want to always be here. You know, I took this job to try and become redundant, not to see it as a career.
Yeah, and in many ways, like many community development initiatives, to try and kind of do yourself out of a role so that it becomes sustainable in its own right, and for the idea of food banks, that they're not necessary, particularly in today's society. So I think the idea of food banks is that people do not become reliant on them, and I guess that's part of your idea of 3 days of food that you provide at a time. Is this lived out, or do you see people becoming increasingly reliant on the use of food banks, or is it just a mixture?
So again, I like to try and use some figures because I think it's the best way of trying to grasp and understand things. But what we have to appreciate is that behind any of the figures that I am able to provide are real human beings and families, and it's the human side of things that has to be paramount. So you can run a report on the Trussell database which tells you how many families, how many times somebody has come over a 6 month period. And the guidance when I started was that three times in 6 months would be what was perhaps usual, acceptable, whatever you want to call it. And when I started, there were only five households that had come more than three times in 6 months. And in each time, they'd been referred by a GP. So if a GP says, for a medical reason, somebody needs ongoing food, I'm going to keep feeding them, because who am I to overrule a GP? No way. If you run that report now, you will find probably 30, 35 people, households that have come 10, 12, 14 times. So we try to take an fresh approach when it comes to eight attendances. Because at that time, if it's become the situation that, let's say, it's Rebecca and Rebecca's gone to a receptionist at a doctor's surgery or at the Citizens Advice Bureau, wherever, and now the attitude of, oh, Rebecca's coming for a food bank voucher, there it is. Yeah. That isn't giving support. We work with referral agencies because, firstly, we want to know a person is getting support for one of the issues they might be facing. And secondly, that means that the request is genuine. Mm-hmm. If it becomes an automatic, then that support has gone. And then everybody again becomes conditioned into, oh, this is how it's going to be. So when we get to eight attendances, we go back to the referrer and say, what are you actually doing to support this person? Or it could be that the person needs to switch to a different referrer. One of the changes, again, that's happened just in the short time that I've been there is initially people might come in 2019, they might have one major issue and maybe something supplemental. Customers now have a mass of issues and they are all very complex. So just one example, if somebody's been mandatorily evicted under a Section 21 notice as a good tenant who's paid their rent, and now all of a sudden they and their family are put into temporary accommodation in a place where the only thing they can have is a kettle, no fridge, no cooking facilities, and your family are in there, and with the housing situation at the moment and the cost of rent at the moment, that very quickly spirals from one issue into multiple issues, including housing, mental health, concern for the children's well-being, debt, etc. So one way is to try and say, okay, you've seen this referrer, this agency for eight times. Do you think seeing somebody different, or do you think having somebody go through your financial circumstances might help you? So that's why we've started a year ago working with the Citizens Advice worker, Tara, who is funded by Trussell. And she has found in the first year £150,000 worth of pensions, benefits and entitlements that Truro Food Bank customers should have been getting that either they didn't know about, or the application process was so darn difficult, they just gave up. Yeah. The Citizens Advice data themselves show that in the Southwest, when a food bank customer has their finances assessed and sorted by a properly trained advisor like Tara, in 39% of cases, that person does not come back to food bank. Okay. Now, that to me is a success story. That's what needs to happen. More of that, please.
Yeah, and it's a shocking statistic, though, isn't it, that actually the process for people being able to access them are so not kind of client-led, as in what people need to get to them, that people can't access the benefits that they're entitled to. I think one of the interesting stories that's been in the media quite frequently, and again is really a terrible situation for us to be in at this time, is the number of people that are working and forced to rely on food banks. Just because they can't afford to live on what they earn, even if they're working full time. It might be both two people in a household that are working. I was wondering whether there are any examples, anonymously obviously, that you could share with us about those situations that might have particularly impacted you in your time as food bank manager.
So if we go back to 2022-23, that's when we really noticed from discussions with customers that so many were coming in on very low paid jobs or on insecure hours. So that got us to think about what can we do to try to assist people in that circumstance. That led us to the Living Wage Foundation and the idea of a living wage place. So a living wage place is somewhere that the employers are encouraged to pay the real living wage, which is the only figure worked out by an independent body, but we can't force it. It's voluntary. The government sets the minimum. The Living Wage Foundation always say that's not enough, people need more. And then we come to the issues in Cornwall of seasonal working and zero-hours contracts being imposed rather than chosen by some employers. So just a couple of examples. I remember two late teenage lads, about 18, 17, 18, 19, living in a tent, but they're painters and decorators. They have jobs, but they can't afford to rent. They can't find anywhere to rent, so they're living in tents and then coming into a food bank to get food bank assistance. At one point, we were feeding about six chefs, all of whom were trained. I remember one in particular. His wife came in because, again, he was too embarrassed to come in. And he said, what happens is the primary chef at this place is on a full-time contract. As the next chef down, I'm on a zero-hours contract. The two assistants under me are on zero-hours contracts. We're required to come in at lunchtime. If we come in at lunchtime and there's no work, then we're just sent home, no pay, no compensation. Sometimes this happens to people that arrange childcare and then pay to travel to work, only to be told there is no work, go home. Mm. That particularly happens at places like some gardens, where particularly if we've had a very wet few days, they turn up for what they think is going to be an 8-hour shift, and the place says, nothing for you here, go away. You, not only then are you not being paid, you've actually paid for childcare, paid for travel, you're actually down, not just level. So this is something that we became aware of. And that's why, as I say, we're recommending, we're part of the Living Wage Place campaign for Cornwall. And lots of employers don't even know what that's about. And if they do know what it's about, they think it's all about benefits for the employee. I've got to pay more. What we encourage people to do is come and have a dialogue with us, come to a couple of the information sessions, find out more about the campaign and things we're posting on social media. If you ever talk to Patrick Langmaid, who is the managing director at Mother Ivy's Holiday Park, Patrick's story is incredible. He had a real road to Damascus conversion. He will tell you that when he took over Mother Ivy's, he would pay the least he could, and whatever he could do to avoid paying tax, he'd do it within legal bounds. And then he realised something opened his mind, and he became the first holiday park in the country to pay the real living wage and to sign up for living hours as well. Because in Patrick's word, if you pay people properly, they will then be loyal to you. They will go a little bit further for you. Their service will be better. You'll retain their experience. If you retain experience, they provide better service. Better service leads to repeat customers. Repeat customers leads to more profit for the business. So when I think about the chefs that were treated so badly by their employers, those employers did not get the bigger picture. They didn't see that actually paying people properly and having fair contract terms isn't just making life better for the employee, it's actually helping the business.
Enhancing the business, yeah. It's shocking, isn't it, to think that people are actually paying out to go to work and then not even being compensated at all for the fact that they're sent home. That must be a really challenging situation, not just financially, but also mentally, I guess, as well.
Well, mentally, put yourself in the position of somebody that's got a family and you need something really important. Item of clothing, repair for a car that's essential, something like that. So your listeners might find this to be a little bit shocking. I found it truly shocking. I've been listening to and going to training by Dave Monk and the Illegal Money Lending Service ever since I started. And they will tell you, as the experts in dealing with loan sharks, some horrendous cases. One person took a £300 loan off a loan shark because they had an essential bill. The amount that they paid back to be finally get rid of that loan was £32,000. Another person took a £20 loan. Within 6 months, they owed £5,000, could see no way out of it, and so thought, the only thing I can do is run some drugs, and got arrested, and their life is in freefall. If people are unwittingly signing up to those kind of arrangements because they need £20 or £300, that's the scale of the problem. That's the issue.
Yeah, it's horrifying, isn't it, to think that actually in the 21st century we're living in a place where there's such poverty and such wealth, but it's not balanced at all, and actually in these situations often the poor just get poorer and are not looked after.
Well, let's just throw a little bit of light on that. So since this living wage campaign for Cornwall started, we've gone from 113 employers accredited with the Living Wage Foundation to over 300. And that means that now 15,000 workers in Cornwall are guaranteed to get the real living wage. When proper research was done on this in 2023, it was estimated there were 60,000 workers in Cornwall that were not paid the real living wage. And despite the Equal Pay Act in 1970, 20% of male part-time jobs were not paying the real living wage, 40% of female part-time jobs. So there's discrimination whichever way you want to look at it, but those impacts are very, very real. But we have made progress, and there's a lot more to do.
Yeah, and I guess also the housing market, particularly in Cornwall, impacts that significantly, because being a holiday destination, people are renting out properties for Airbnb and things like that, and so there's less kind of rental accommodation available privately at a reasonable cost for people year round. Is that still the case?
Yes. I mean, housing is a huge issue. I know there's some very passionate people about dealing with housing, so I won't go speaking into that. I'll leave that for others. But the way that we find it is there's an increase in the number of single male homeless that we see coming to True Food Bank. There's an increase in the number of people that are sleeping in vans or cars coming to Food Bank. And again, some's making the decision that, do I keep the flat or do I keep the van? Well, I can earn income from the van, so they give the flat keys back, knowing how difficult it's probably going to be to ever then get accommodation again. So it's not a decision that they make lightly, but that, yeah, we definitely see an increase in that. The work we do with St Petrox and the rough sleeping resettlement workers. And if it's okay, I'll give a massive shout out to Claire and her team there, because the work they do with people that are in really broken situations is amazing. But unfortunately, it's a growing need.
Yeah, and it sounds like it. So is there a final thought that you'd like to share about your work that you'd particularly like listeners to consider?
I would say it is about trying to find solutions. If people would like to be, how shall I phrase this, constructively feisty with their elected representatives, and ask councillors, ask MPs, do you actually know what is happening in terms of food insecurity in your constituency? Do you actually have a dialogue with the food banks at all? Is this something which is taken for granted? Because too often food banks are used as photo moments and somebody will pop up for a minute, have a photograph taken and then disappear again. My belief, our belief is that you've got to have collaboration, you've got to have meaningful dialogue. People need to understand the reasons and what is going on behind that. So unless we all ask those questions, then again, it's too easy for people to just forget about it, and it becomes inconvenient. So, yeah, I would say ask. Go and find out. Find out what's really happening in your particular area.
Thank you. That's lovely. And thank you for sharing your time and your experience with us this afternoon. I think there's been some really harrowing stories and examples shared within that. So thank you for all the work that you're doing on behalf of those people that are struggling in that way.
Well, I shall pass that thank on to the volunteers as well, because, as I say, without them, then we wouldn't have the doors open. But thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. You've been listening to CMD Bite Size Podcasts, produced by the Diocese of Truro. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do follow and share. To listen to similar podcasts, please visit the Truro Diocese website. If there is a subject you would like us to include, please email us at ministry@truro.anglican.org.